From NPR News, this is Foreign Dispatch. It's our weekly roundup that includes some of the best reports from NPR correspondents around the globe. I'm Greg Myrie. On the podcast this week, we'll get an update on the U.S. offensive in Afghanistan. And we'll hear about the economic turmoil that's rocking Greece. We'll also check in on Haiti and the children who were orphaned there by the recent earthquake. We begin in southern Afghanistan, where U.S. commanders are sharing credit with the Afghan forces for the success in the recent offensive in and around the town of Marja. The American officers say the Afghans contributed capable troops to the operation, which took control of an area that had been dominated by the Taliban. Close to 2,000 members of the Afghan security forces fought alongside nearly 5,000 U.S. troops. But there are still questions about the ability of the Afghans to coordinate with foreign troops on the battlefield. NPR's Corey Flintoff has the report.
The combined force that captured this poppy-growing region included 1,250 Afghan Army troops, or ANA, and about 600 National Police. They fought alongside nearly 5,000 Marines and soldiers from an Army Striker Brigade. Colonel Randy Newman, commander of the 6th Marine Regiment, says that, on the whole, the ANA performed very well.
I've been impressed with what they've offered us. And some people will point out some individual actions, some small actions in areas where they've done things that we wouldn't prefer. And I don't dispute those.
But Newman says the problem soldiers represent only a very small portion of the number of Afghans involved in the fight. One reason the Afghans performed well, officers say, is that their ranks included many soldiers with fighting experience in other parts of the country. That's Afghan Army Colonel Farooq Tarahil, who says this wasn't the first battle for his unit. They've been tested, he says, by fighting the Taliban in Khost province and other parts of the country. Colonel Newman says there's no question of the Afghans' courage in battle.
As often as I've heard stories of them perhaps being mean to the people or something, I've heard equal stories of them being more than eager to enter into the fray.
But that eagerness was a problem last month for Marines in a combat situation where Afghan soldiers pushed ahead without coordinating with their partners. NPR correspondent Soraya Sarhadi Nelson was with a Marine patrol on the third day of the Marja offensive when that lack of coordination delayed an airstrike against Taliban fighters and created a danger of friendly fire. The Marines were under fire, taking cover behind a wall, and their captain was trying to call an airstrike on the source of the shooting. Captain Joshua Kondo was frustrated because Afghan soldiers, the ANA, had run ahead without telling him, putting themselves too close to an area where he wanted to direct the airstrike.
Yeah, no, we're taking fire.
Well, tell them to push back so I can get the aircraft in.
Hey, push back.
Kondo also complained that the ANA seemed to be firing in an undisciplined way.
We're being told that fire that was on the north side of the canal was ANA. They're jackasses that fired over our heads.
The Marines had reports of Taliban fighters with a machine gun moving to set up an ambush. Kondo yelled to the Marine who was the liaison with the ANA.
That commander, you got to get him under control, dude. Now they're all over the battlefield,
yeah,
and I can't prosecute
sure,
anything. There's a guy out there with RPG and machine gun, and we can't do because they're running like jackasses.
The captain and his platoon leader, First Lieutenant Justin Gray, moved to set up the airstrike while trying to let the ANA know what they were doing.
Escorters, can we do a combined sequential attack with the Hellfire? Are you capable? Do you have the Hellfire on board?
Affirmative.
Not him, you got behind, right
on. No, tell him that the planes are about to shoot over there.
No, I'm at his head.
When asked why he had led his men ahead without telling the Marines, the Afghan captain, Mohammed Gharib, said his men had spotted a teenage boy in the area and wanted to check him out. The Marja offensive was designed to test putting the ANA in the lead, so technically they weren't required to follow the Marines' orders, but Marine officers say they needed to be reined in. Now that the shooting has stopped, Afghan soldiers are showing a strong presence in the Marja area, and Colonel Tarahil says that's a role that brings out their biggest strength. He says his men know the language and the local culture, and they're better equipped to solve local problems and bring peace to the region. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Helmand Province, Afghanistan.
In Greece, the government is trying to fix the country's economic mess with a series of austerity measures. But hundreds of thousands of union members recently went on strike to protest the moves, and thousands more also took to the streets. NPR's Eric Westerfeldt looks at how the austerity plan has divided Greece.
The Greek government says it needs to cut the equivalent of $6.5 billion from the budget in order to rein in an out-of-control deficit that has not only wrecked the Greek economy, but also shaken confidence in the European currency, the euro. The union members say that tax increases and deep cuts in public sector wages unfairly penalize middle and working-class Greeks for the previous government's overspending. Spiros Papaspiros is a senior official with Greece's largest civil servants union.
Over the next few months, as these latest cuts from the government are implemented, there will be widespread effects, both in this economy and society, and a drop in the standard of living here. In my opinion, there's a danger it's going to lead us into recession rather than leading us out of recession.
But others see the very workers taking to the streets today as the main problem for Greece's economy. Athens University economist George Bitros says the public sector here is ineffectual and bloated with political patronage jobs for whichever party is in power. The government, Bitros says, has to aggressively cut the public sector despite tenure rules that make it very hard to fire public workers.
The situation is unsustainable. If you have a company and you cannot pay your workers, what do? You let them go, right? If a state is bankrupt, what do? They should find a way to fire people. I don't care. The state is a big enterprise. It's a corporation. The corporation cannot employ workers while it cannot pay them.
In Kolonaki Square, a posh section of the city, well-heeled Athenians dine in fine restaurants as taxi driver Panos Kanalupithis waits for a fare. He says the austerity measures are hypocritical. Tax evasion and petty bribery in his country are widespread. Why doesn't the government go after the rich, he asks, for not paying their fair share of taxes? They don't prosecute anyone, he says. But then he concedes it's not just the rich who cheat the Greek tax man.
Yeah, I want to be honest. If I could do it, I would try to hide something. Because I have to make a living, you know. The salaries here in Greece are in one-third of the average European.
Kanalupithis says Greeks might go along with these latest austerity measures if they had any faith in the state to use their money wisely.
I think this is the primary reason. We're not born cheaters, you know. I mean, I'm 42 right now. We have a very poor healthcare system. We have a very poor education system. In fact, they're getting worse and worse, year by year. So where are all the taxes gone?
Officials at the Greek Ministry of Finance are vowing to finally get tough on tax evasion, which they estimate costs the country billions of euros a year. But they're putting their faith in new technology, not face-to-face auditors. One official said too many Greek tax collectors today are open to an envelope under the table. The Greek branch of the anti-corruption group Transparency International says Greece has one of the largest underground economies in the 16-member eurozone. The government estimates that the untaxed shadow economy here is at least 30% of the declared economy. Kostas Bakouras with Transparency International hopes this crisis finally makes Greeks realize that corruption is a threat to the country's future, its competitiveness, and stability.
When you have corruption, what happens? You have markets which are crooked, you don't have free competition, they're not all having the same opportunities to compete, the nation becomes less competitive, and when it becomes less competitive, it becomes poorer. It is corruption that makes countries poor, not the other way around.
But Greeks are not falling in line behind the unprecedented austerity measures, and many say the outlook here is bleak. As one worker told me, I love my country, but my government is crooked. I tell my son to leave. The future is elsewhere. Eric Westerfeldt, NPR News, Athens.
Coming up, many children orphaned by Haiti's earthquake are still searching for a permanent home.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the all-new MDX with super-handling all-wheel drive. More information is available at Acura.com.
This is Foreign Dispatch. I'm Greg Myrie. Haiti is a country of children. Half the population there is under 18. And since the earthquake in January, you see kids everywhere in the streets. They carry water buckets, they push wheelbarrows full of rubble, or they pass the time playing with homemade toy cars. NPR's Debbie Elliott takes a closer look at one group of boys.
These teenage boys are huddled around a radio listening to Creole rap. They're unrelated, but have formed a brotherhood in the disaster. Five of them, including 16-year-old Luxon, are living without shelter or adult supervision in a park near the airport road in Port-au-Prince.
After the earthquake, all of us came here to sleep. Then, because we were staying there together to sleep, then we meet each other, and then that's why we came together.
Their homes and neighborhoods collapsed.
All my family died.
No.
I heard they are somewhere, but I don't know the place.
The boys do odd jobs to earn money, like fixing cars that break down on the way to the airport. 16-year-old Jean says they share food and try to survive with what little they have.
Since the earthquake, we have been using like those clothes that we are having on. We wash them and then we put them on.
The UN Children's Fund estimates that more than 20,000 children lost their parents in the earthquake. Many are being cared for by relatives or neighbors, but others, like these boys, are alone. Humanitarian groups are working to track them and reunite families when possible. Each child is entered into a searchable database with information about where they used to live and whether they have relatives in the countryside. Late on a Friday afternoon, a team of social workers comes to register the boys. They take photographs and say they'll be back Monday morning to take them to an orphanage, where they will be cared for and able to resume their studies until caregivers can be found. UNICEF officials say they've registered 300 children so far and reunited about a dozen families. It takes detective work, says Marie de la Soudière, coordinator of UNICEF's Separated Children Fund in Haiti. Until caregivers are found, the agency tries to place kids in orphanages or designated child-safe tents in the spontaneous camps where earthquake victims have settled. Soudière says there is danger in the chaos of disaster.
Two things happen. A, you can take children that are lost and nobody will even find you. And B, you can easily take advantage of desperate parents who don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. Because their lack of knowledge that aid is coming and it's there, if they really know how to get it, then they just say, take my child.
Even before the earthquake, there were more than 300,000 orphans in Haiti, many of them given up by destitute parents, and in the worst cases, handed over to wealthy families as servants, known as restivecs in Creole. Since the earthquake, the government has tightened its watch on child trafficking and temporarily halted adoptions.
No one has the right to take a child out of this country.
Carol Stern is the president and CEO of the U.S. Fund for UNICEF.
And you hear frequently in the States especially, well, but we can provide for them so much better. Where do you draw that line then? You know, so this summer when it's really hot and the kids in a ghetto or neighborhood who don't have air conditioning, are we going to pluck those kids and take them to parents who have air conditioning because they can provide for them better? No one has the right to decide where a child should be except that child's family.
In a perfect world, yes, UNICEF, I would love to see international adoption stopped. I would love to see Haitians take in and adopt a child without making it a slave in their home.
Dixie Bickle, an American who has lived in Haiti since 1991, runs God's Littlest Angels, an orphanage about 45 minutes outside Port-au-Prince. There are about 60 children staying here now, mostly infants and toddlers she's taken in from other orphanages that were destroyed. Bickle is frustrated by what she sees as hostility toward orphanages like hers.
Nobody says a thing because mothers give up their kids in the U.S., because we know they can't take care of their kids. But in Haiti, it's made to look like it's an illegal trafficking situation because the mother says, I would rather give up my baby than see it die in my arms.
Bickle says until the cultural system in Haiti changes to support families with children, institutions like hers are crucial. Some U.S. senators, including Louisiana Democrat Mary Landrieu, believe the influx of international aid after the earthquake provides an opportunity to build a modern child welfare system in Haiti.
The problem is there's no safety net of support services in Haiti, to my understanding, today, and it causes many parents to want to or to be forced to or encouraged to abandon their children.
On Monday morning, the teenage boys are up early, backpacks on, waiting for the social workers to return for them. A boy named Steve sings, "It makes me so happy that I have a chance today." He says the group wants to get back to school so they will have a future.
Me, what I would like is like every one of us have something to do. Like if this one could be an engineer, this one could be a doctor, it would be great. Everybody could live.
The social workers arrive late and come with bad news.
Okay.
The orphanage won't take the boys because they're too old. The social workers say the plan now is to give them a tent in one of the settlement camps throughout the city. The smile fades from Luxon's face. He doesn't like the idea.
We will always stay there until we find somebody that is not lying so they can help us, really.
I'm not happy, he says, and sits down on one of the brick garden walls that have been his home since January 12th. In his pocket, a folded piece of notebook paper with a poem neatly written in English.
My name is Luxon. I'm 16 years old. My mother and my father died. I don't have no one to help me. I don't have nobody in Haiti. I'm sleeping in the street. My sister and my brother died. Please let me go with you.
I need adoption, he writes. Please help me. Debbie Elliott, NPR News, Port-au-Prince.
For more international coverage, you can listen to your local NPR station. You'll find a list at our website, npr.org. And while you're there, you can find more international stories by clicking on News and World. For NPR News, I'm Greg Myrie.